You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 4th of February 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, peace talks aimed at ending the war in Syria crumble as Russia vows to press ahead with airstrikes. Meanwhile, Germany aims for a decidedly different tone in Russian relations after the Bavarian premier gets cozy with Vladimir Putin. We'll also assess why Ukraine's president sees an increasing risk of all-out war with Russia. Plus, the European Union approves a €3 billion payment to Turkey in exchange for its cooperation in stemming migrant numbers. But why is Italy holding back? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Shashank Joshi, research fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, or RUSI, and he covers war and conflict there, and also the author and broadcaster, Michael Goldfarb. Welcome both to the programme. Now, peace talks between Syria's government and opposition were always destined to walk a very delicate tightrope. So when the talks were suspended last night, sadly, very few were surprised. Despite the arrival of the opposition's negotiation committee coordinator, comments by Russia's foreign minister ate away at much of the meeting's chances of success. With watering down of Russia's economy and the ever-intensifying political situation, the chances for a friendly diplomatic relationship are also on hold at the moment. But we'll come to Syria first. Just tell us, Shashank, were you surprised at the collapse of the talks?
Well, I mean, I think no one was surprised by this. It was a question of really how catastrophically they would break down. In other words, would they stay in sufficiently good shape to tide us over till next month, or would there be real bitterness, rancor, and would they collapse completely? In this case, I think we can see the cause of it is fairly straightforward. It's the Russian offensive on Aleppo. It's something to do with the wrangling over the opposition delegation as well. But that's not the real issue. The real issue here, of course, is Russia has had an extremely good week on the battlefield, pushing the Syrian army on, potentially cutting Aleppo off from some of those Turkish supply lines. And for the rebels, they just couldn't tolerate this. So I suppose it partly depends on how the battlefield actually moves as to how quickly this resumes again.
So, Michael, in short, we have peace talks only, really, a meaningful peace talks only if the Syrian regime is losing. If they've got a winning streak, then they're not that keen.
I think that that's always the way it works, particularly in these kinds of civil wars. I mean, one of the things that surprised me, or continues to surprise me, actually, John Kerry, the Secretary of State, is clearly an interesting kind of activist. He believes that if you're talking, you're talking, and that's a good thing. But my memory, when I first came into these stories 25 years ago during the Bosnian Civil War, is there's no point in convening a major conference in Switzerland or Vienna. These are the two preferred venues for peace conferences, if you haven't got a decent enough chance of success. Because what you do is you put pressure on the combatants, the insurgents, to come, and perhaps they haven't gained what they need to gain on the battlefield. Perhaps they're not politically strong. You might be talking to someone who commands a large force but doesn't have any political base behind him. You force them to go to these talks, they disintegrate, and then when they go back to their country, suddenly they're being overthrown from within by younger commanders in the field, for example, or other political activists. It's a dreadful idea to bring people together for 48 hours just to say, well, we're trying, which is what I think John Kerry's about. And so I'm not surprised it happens. I just think it's a really, really dangerous thing. And no, I mean, just to go back to the Bosnian War again, there were many attempts at having talks, but the only time they succeeded was after it had reached the point where Slobodan Milosevic, who was backing the Bosnian Serbs, saw them rolled out of western Bosnia with the help of the Croatians and the Muslims, came together and they forced them back. They were losing on the battlefield. And that's when he said, okay, we can have a serious discussion about ending this. So long as Russia and the regime, the Assad regime, can surround Aleppo, and create even more chaos. We're reading of 70,000 people in the last 72, 96 hours coming out of Aleppo, heading for Turkey. Turkey can't hold on to them. They will eventually force their way towards Europe. This is a crisis for all. And so long as they have that power, then there can be no possibility of sitting down to discuss terms of even a ceasefire.
Shashank, when we look at the bombing campaign that's being led by Russia, do you think it's fair, the criticism that's come out of Western capitals over the last day or so is the Russians do not want peace. The Russians want to bomb the opposition. The peace talks are a bit of a smoke and mirror game, and they're not really attacking ISIS anymore. That they really are just going around the opposition who have their troops closest to the Syrian regime. Is that a fair appraisal of what's happening, do you think?
Well, on the first part, everyone wants peace on their own terms. It's just that the Russians happen to see a situation where their bargaining position is going up day by day, and therefore the likelihood of getting their terms tomorrow is higher than it is today. On the second part of that, are they bombing ISIS? The answer is that criticism is absolutely fair. About a small proportion of their target list is composed of ISIS. Look at where the fighting is, around those parts of Aleppo, around Latakia, elsewhere. They are resolutely focused on non-ISIS groups. Now, that, of course, does include some extremist groups. It includes al-Nusra, who are also fighting in those ranks. But it includes a large number of those who we once called moderate, we now call mainstream, and somewhere probably, sit in the grey area in between, like the Saudi-backed Salafis.
Just before I bring Michael back in, just tell me, on this bombing campaign, well, both of you, we were told that, it was impossible to, bomb your way to peace. Only a few weeks ago, we were being told, the Russians will try and do what the Americans done and try and do what everyone else has done in the region. You drop bombs, you cause some chaos, but you cannot really change the game. Well, they've kind of proved it wrong, haven't they? The Russians, the Russians are kind of changing the frontiers, in the battle frontiers, very fast. Whereas the campaigns being run by the Allied forces against ISIS in the east of the country seem to be kind of pottering along, but not really moving in this way.
Well, there's two big differences. One of them is they're dropping far more bombs, mostly unguided, by the way, getting rid of some of their old rubbish ammunition from the 90s. And that makes an enormous difference when you don't care about civilian casualties, an enormous difference. And number two, of course, they have ground forces. The Syrian Arab Army, probably the least effective, also Iranian forces, smaller in number than they were 6 months ago, but still there. And I would say very significantly in some of the places we've seen in the past week, Hezbollah probably being the most tactically effective fighting force in northern Syria. If we had Hezbollah and Syrian forces with tanks and Iranians fighting to liberate Raqqa today with US air power, we could do it in a few weeks.
Michael, just before we move on from this point of the discussion, again, when you see what is unfolding, what do you think are the logical next steps? If Aleppo falls to the Syrian government, as you say, it doesn't mean that that city then becomes a peaceful city and can be rebuilt and life returns to normal. So many people have been forced out that will never be able to return. Lives have changed forever. It's not really moving the borders in this campaign. Are not really the end solution, are they?
Well, no, they aren't. I'm assuming that the reason they're making a big push on Aleppo is one, aside from pushing rebels out, is that if they do manage to completely subdue it, claim that they have control over it, then they'll have control of Damascus, Aleppo, and Homs, which are the three largest cities in Syria, all in the western part of the country. But what do they have control of? I mean, one of the things, and I'm very happy to be in the studio with Shashank, because he works much more regularly and closely with policymakers inside the British government, is it's been clear for several years now that this is a country that cannot be put back together. I mean, there's been the most dramatic footage. Some of our listeners will probably have seen it. A drone flew through Homs, and it's going all over social networks. It's astonishing footage.
Remarkable, yeah.
You cannot look at that city, and they'll be doing the same thing in Aleppo in order to capture it. You can't look at that city and say, we can put this back together again. There's a donor conference today in London about reconstruction and providing relief for Syrian refugees. You can't reconstruct this country. It is, and it would be, my own view is that the real, that realism should take hold of some of our senior policymakers, including John Kerry and Sergei Lavrov, and say, look, we need to discuss redrawing the map of this particular country. And this may be a way to sustain the Assad regime if that's an important goal for the Russians. I don't know. But I just can't see realistically. I mean, we're talking about realism. The realistic position to me seems to be that you have to say the Syria that's existed since 1917, 1918, whenever the Sykes-Picot Agreement was, simply cannot continue.
Well, there's the consequences of migration, and we will come back to that. But for the moment, we're going to stay on the topic of Russia, because ever since they invaded the east of Ukraine, relationships with Germany have been on a rather sour note. But not everyone is on the same page, however, because one of the members of Germany's political establishment, Horst Seehofer, who's the premier of Bavaria and a key member of Angela Merkel's coalition, has been off to see Mr. Putin and has been photographed today shaking his hands and saying that it's time for a bit of a rapprochement. Michael, is he just kind of... It's interesting. He says, you know, a large amount of the stuff we make in Bavaria ends up in Germany. 20% of our, you know, our GDP as a region ends up going to Russia. So is this just a great example of somebody who sees money and opportunity and who kind of then begins to forget about the bigger moral questions?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I suppose there's realpolitik in this. I mean, when the civil war in Ukraine began. I mean, we cannot be correct and say when Russia invaded eastern Ukraine, but we can say when Putin aided his proxies to basically divide that country. It was a huge outcry in the West. But the reality is that there is trade. It goes back and forth all the time, has done, you know, it's part of, look at the geography and look at the map. I don't think this, you know, I don't know who this particular Bavarian politician is or what his motivations are, but there has to be, and this is something that the real anti-Putinists, particularly here in London, have lost sight of. There is the reality, the same reality that existed in the Cold War. West Germany was always more open to a kind of rapprochement, to, you know, open conversations, trade with the Soviet Union, and I'm sure it drove a lot of conservatives in London mad. This is the reality of geography. And I also think it's the reality of the moment. The parts of eastern Ukraine that have been taken by the rebels seem to be pretty much consolidated. And I just think he's speaking realistically about normalizing a situation that 18 months ago seemed outrageous.
Shashank, can that relationship just be normalized in this way, just be kind of politely forgetting about the fact that, you know, Crimea was snatched by the Russians, that they've kind of effectively changed the nature of the eastern borders of Ukraine? You know, when we've just seen in London a good example of somebody, you know, the outcome of a hearing that shows that somebody who was here was probably murdered by the Russians. Some, you know, suggestions it goes right to the top of the Kremlin. You know, the fissures between East and West are so bad now. Can it really just snap back if one or two politicians think, OK, we'll go and shake hands and we'll do a few kind of deals for money?
Well, all politics is local. And while I think Merkel has a very, very keen strategic sense of German-Russian relations, and she always has, very pragmatic, but because they were so pragmatic, all the more significant when she pivoted against Russia along with France in that crucial moment in the Ukrainian crisis. But all politics is local. Merkel is in a weaker political position than she was a year ago. Of course, a chunk of that is to do with the migrant crisis. Her handling of the migrant crisis over the next 6 months will also shape that political power. And we have seen this in certain particular areas. This is a call to normalize relations. One of the biggest elements of that is whether Germany will look favorably upon the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, a big pipeline that would increase European dependence on Russian energy. Another part of this is Syria, of course. One of the major reasons Russia escalated in Syria was to force normalization over Ukraine sanctions and end Ukraine sanctions. And Germany is a pivot in this. So I think it'll depend on her local domestic position. But there has always been, as we just heard, a kind of Russophile streak in German politics, sort of Ostpolitik politic strand in their thinking. Gerhard Schroeder, of course, is the most flagrant manifestation of this, you know, Berlusconi-type figure who loves hobnobbing with Putin. Merkel is much more astute, much more sensible. She has a keen sense of Europe. I mean, I'm someone who really rates her strategic nous, and I think that we shouldn't panic just because a couple of provincial politicians say this, but watch the politics at home.
We've also seen in the last few days headlines about, you know, how quickly Russia could invade the Baltics if it wanted to. Concerns from the Baltic nations about how quickly NATO will be able to kind of boost, you know, kind of their position.
And there's also been the idea that the U.S. is going to be reinforcing its NATO presence in the East. They're going to be sending larger numbers of troops.
And this is, you know, key for Germany, because Germany is a kind of, you know, a guarantor, you know, of all those countries, you know, to its east. Yeah. So in a way, does it, you know, Shashank, do you think this also complicates things for, you know, even if Germany wanted to just kind of, you know, forget what's happened in Ukraine, there's people sitting in, you know, in Tallinn, in Riga, thinking, yeah, this could be us, Germany. Yep. Don't start making too many friends here.
There will absolutely be that anxiety, but that's ever present in these small countries whose fate is wound up with the great powers of Europe to the west. They will also worry about the UK. They in some ways will breathe a sigh of relief that the review blamed Russia, Putin, for Litvinenko's murder, because of course that in some ways reinforces Britain's stance towards Russia. But it's important to recognize Germany has decided to lead on the Very High Readiness Task Force, the rapid response force that is designed for Russia contingencies. And so they are no shrinking violets. They're not simply sitting back saying, you know, playing the good cop to the French or British bad cop. It isn't how it is. I think that Germany actually has performed reasonably sensibly with regard to Russia in the last year or so.
And the last point on this, Michael, we never know how Russia reacts to these things. But in a way, are we kind of in a kind of odd kind of ease in the end in Europe, because Russia just doesn't have the cash at the moment. You know, it's got an oil-dependent country.
Shrunk by 3% last year.
Well, one worries in this particular case that, you know, foreign adventures are often very, very useful to distract people from a collapsing economy at home. And we know that nationalism plays a very, very strong part in Putin's popularity. I mean, people forget in the West, because he is demonized, and in some cases, rightly so. He's in that respect, he's a dangerous guy. But at home, by all accounts, and by whatever measures of public opinion you can count as scientific, he is popular. He is popular because he plays to a nationalist card, a revanchist card in the case of Ukraine. And, you know, we'll see. My overview on it always is that Russia does very, very badly when it gets involved in fighting in Muslim parts of the world, even in Muslim parts of Russia. And no matter how powerful and overwhelming their forces surrounding Aleppo at the moment, I don't necessarily think that they are in for an easy ride. I think that the rebels are more than capable of making life miserable and sending Russians back in body bags, and that might change things. But we're talking about things for months from now, not this moment.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Shashank Joshi, and also Michael Goldfarb. Coming up next, the media cycle may have moved on, but Ukraine's president sees only a heightened risk of war with Russia. Plus, where does Turkey sit in curbing Europe's migrant crisis? Stay with us.
Madrid is a changing city. Unlike other Spanish destinations, Madrid hasn't bowed to the tourist hordes in order to weather the economic downturn. Instead, the regeneration has been led by Madrileños themselves. This newly reinvented Madrid is a melting pot of talent, taste, and citywide tenacity. Monocle's editors and correspondents share their discoveries in the new Monocle Travel Guide to Madrid.
If there is one thing to take from this guide, it's that Madrid isn't lacking in colour and diversity, and that's certainly the case for accommodation and hospitality. Hotels have a palpable Spanish flavour to them. Bespoke furnishings are made by local designers, and delicious menus prepared by Madrid's top chefs.
To catch a glimpse of Monocle's Madrid, head to the film section of monocle.com.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me, of course, are Shashank Joshi and Michael Goldfarb. Well, we'll turn our attention now to Ukraine, where, despite repeated news of ceasefires and a waning presence in the international news cycle, chances for peace remain on edge. After meeting with Germany's Angela Merkel recently, Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko told Bild newspaper that he sees the risk of open war with Russia greater than it was a year ago. After watching Moscow build up its military presence along the border, Ukraine's leader says there is little reason to believe that the lingering threat of Russian incursion is going to go away. Michael, you know, we've been talking about, you know, all of these kind of fronts on which, you know, Russia is, you know, working at the moment, and its troops being pulled into Syria. Again, you know, is that just kind of, you know, a reality check for the Russians? You know, that there was, we said that, you know, they don't have the money to really ramp up their military machine at the moment. They're getting heavily involved in Syria. That in a way, maybe the only reason peace might maintain in the east of Ukraine is because of the lack of energy to push further and to get more involved. Or are you with Poroshenko thinking that actually it could all begin again?
No, I'm not with Poroshenko on this. I mean, I think he's doing what leaders do. They come into the West and they try and get some headlines that you forgot us. You've forgotten us. He's got his own domestic political problems. So he has to come and say, you've forgotten us, and get some headlines and say, they're going to come again. I think that, I mean, Shashank may disagree, but I think that Russia got what it wanted. I mean, it got the Crimea, and it got that eastern segment of Ukraine, the Donbass, and then that was sort of what they wanted anyway. It was mostly ethnic Russian to begin with, and so why push forward? I think for them, they get much more. Oh, I'm not going to say it for their buck by being present in Syria than they do by stirring up Ukraine at this moment. I think they just do, but
Well, there is a genuine trade-off. It's not that they have to draw down in Ukraine to support Syria operations. Syria is primarily an air campaign, and the best pilots are in Syria, and they don't need to be involved in Ukraine. But in terms of the units who are prepared in Western Russia, there is a trade-off, and they have had to draw some of those down, lower training routines in order to sustain the Russia commitment. So there is a trade-off. I do think, though, that they've got some of what they want. For me, Eastern Donbass particularly, it's not an acquisition or an asset. It's a pipeline. It's a kind of place they can use to pump up or down the flow to apply pressure on the West. And right now, it's at a fairly low pressure because that suits them. But they still want something from Kiev. They still need Kiev to take over more of the burden for the East. They are still struggling to keep the lights on in Crimea, which is having a serious power crisis. It's being affected by sabotage against pipelines and supplies from mainland Ukraine. So it satisfies them for now that this lever is there to be used as and when necessary, but I still think that it's something that will cost them in the long run, and they would rather de-escalate when the time is ripe. But for now, I think Syria is the overwhelming focus, and that's getting them much more.
But in Ukraine, you think there will be a point when they want to calm things further than they are now? Because, as you say, what's interesting, we were talking about the Baltics. What seems intriguing is they have made a situation where all these other countries now feel nervous about, you know, oh, I wonder if it could happen to us. It's put a lot of people on edge. It's made lots of people reassess their relations with Russia.
Ukraine, I think they do need to de-escalate at some point, but I'm talking years here, and that's for two fundamental reasons. One of them is Ukraine and the military operations in Ukraine, and holding on to Donbass is a financial burden. It's an expensive place to run, and that's why they want Kiev to fund it and to return to normal. Kiev, of course, says, why on earth will I pay, you know, municipal council fees and electricity in somewhere you're occupying? But the second, much bigger reason is, until they solve and de-escalate Ukraine in some fashion, sanctions will remain on Russia. And those sanctions are still serious. Let's not forget that just because Putin has taken the headlines and is loved at the G7 and all of this. At the end of the day, his economy is going to suffer, and he still needs a political solution. He just hopes he can get it via Syria rather than via Ukraine.
Michael, just quickly, lastly on this, you know, is part of the problem also for Poroshenko is that, you know, that as time has gone on, the West has begun to wonder at his leadership a little bit, and also about the transparency of, you know, the regime. It feels, you know, it feels a bit of a kleptocracy at times. You know, there's so many oligarchs still kind of managing to cream off so much money that actually, that's why he's kind of gone out of favor a bit, because people felt that he would be, you know, after the Maidan, you know, troubles, they felt that he would come in and clean up politics, and he hasn't.
Well, I don't know that he can, to be honest. And I think he also, we also lose sight of the fact that, you know, public, the, that within Ukraine, as, you know, the western part of the country is, isn't as in love with Kiev as perhaps Washington or London is. I mean, they in the western, heavily nationalist part of the country, there are some who would like to have a proper civil war or just be rid of the East. And to see, you know, Poroshenko's kind of, he's a Western-educated technocrat. He speaks brilliant English. The elites in our countries feel very comfortable with him. But is he a strong enough politician within Ukraine to be able to, you know, shape policy? I think that's still an open question.
Now, we don't have much time left, but we want to touch finally on a story out of Turkey. The EU has approved a payment of 3 billion euros to help Turkey cope with record numbers of Syrian migrants. The payment was made in exchange for Turkey's cooperation with the EU's plans to curb the growing numbers of migrants seeking refuge in Europe. The Italians, however, aren't so keen on the deal, worried that the money that they give maybe then not offset in the a nice way for their benefit as well. Shashank, what do you make of this? First of all, the Italians, you know, holding out, and what the Turks are being asked to do.
I think it's first of all a reminder about how split Europe is. NATO Europe, how we have one big chunk of Europe looking east at Russia and being frightened, and the other half looking south and being frightened, and each half at war with the other. But on the specific issue, you know, it shows us how alienated countries like Greece, Italy, Spain, Portugal are when they hear us fixating on the Baltics, on Ukraine, on Donbass. They don't care about this. They care about adequate European support for migrant rescue, for diminishing the migrant crisis, for support at the borders. And right now, we're seeing a particularly petty form of that, as Italy is saying, well, we can have the 3 billion, but if you even think about counting the money we spend on migrant rescue against our obligation to minimize the deficit, we will block the entire funding. So, you know,
well,
there you go.
And it's interesting because Greece, Italy, Spain, Portugal all bear the brunt, and they've also borne the brunt of the last 10 years of economic problems. And, you know, they're the ones who've had to pay the heavy price to be bailed out and in order to stay in the euro. And they're paying, you know, a very heavy economic and social price for that. But what I'd just like to say and remind people is that, I mean, a tremendous amount of the problem comes, frankly, via the Turkish government. It's easy enough to be sympathetic because they've had this massive outflow, close to 2 million people from Syria, and it's hard for them to deal with it. On the other hand, the government of President Erdogan, the AKP government, has in many ways made finding a solution in Turkey all the more difficult. They've gone to war at the moment. They seem to have gone to war with their own Kurdish population. The PKK is very closely allied to the YPG. All of these letters mean something, believe me. In Syria, and they're the only effective ground force so far against ISIS. And what they've done is they've made fighting ISIS all the more difficult It means finding a solution to the overall Syria problem all the more difficult. And so long as these difficulties exist, people are going to keep streaming into Turkey, and whether it's a blind eye or whatever, will be turned towards them as they work their way to the Mediterranean and get on leaky dinghies to try to get to Greece. And I have to say, I mean, I think that to give 3 billion euros to Turkey without some kind of very strong strings attached. Say, these are the steps you need to take.
Well, the EU does strings very well.
Do they?
Well, the EU will have, you know, 50,000 implementation advisors now streaming across every inch of Turkey for the next 20 years.
Taking the dinghies back over to Turkey from Greece.
Gentlemen, we're going to have to leave it there. That was Shashank Joshi and Michael Goldfarber. Thank you very much to both of them for joining us here on Midori House. Today's show was produced by Ben Ryland. It was researched by Fernando Acosta Pacheco and also by Yasmin Omar. And our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. For the next half hour, Carlo Torrebello will be keeping you company with Monocle's International Playlist. I'll be back at 1900 hours today with a special episode of The Urbanist, presented in association with the Cinema Show. But for now, from me, Andrew Tuck, goodbye.